First, just a quick agenda, what we're going to go through today, so you can decide when and where you're going to pay attention. First thing I want to do, we're going to do a quick review of your last lesson with Bill Clem. I want to hear kind of what you guys took away from that after you've steeped on it for a month, what you've been thinking about. The only real teaching component that I don't know if it's even going to be totally new, but one thing that I just want to hit today is why we do community at Mars Hill, because you guys, as potential upcoming elders, I really want to make sure that we understand kind of what the underlying reasons why, theological reasons why. And then the bulk of the time, because the majority of you are coming up either through community groups or have extensive experience with community groups at Mars Hill, I wanted to do the majority of this as question and answer, because you guys have read the book. You know most of the stuff that I would just present, and so what I'd rather do is be able to take questions that you guys have, maybe things that you were intrigued by in the book, maybe things you disagreed with. Not that that's possible, but if there was something that you wanted more clarity on, and just practical, okay, how do we apply this in our context, whether we're downtown Bellevue or Ballard, how does this stuff play out? And so you can be, as you're thinking through forming some of those questions, what are the areas that you want to talk about? I broke down kind of some areas so you could, you know, jog your memory on the book, and maybe some stuff that you might have had questions about. How many of you guys are or have led, coached community groups at your campus?
At your church.
At your church. Oh. The only one. Not there. All right. What are you doing?
I'm in Bellevue, but I'm not there any longer, right? So
okay.
That's what I'm saying. I wasn't just hammering on the campus.
Yeah, no worries.
So in Bellevue I did.
Okay.
But not at downtown.
Awesome. How you doing, sir? rock and roll. You sitting with the downtown crew? I see.
Yeah, temporarily.
Temporarily. So I want to be able to go through those, and then I have some case studies at the bottom that if we exhaust all questions, then we can work through some case studies that I think are helpful as elders when you're thinking through making decisions and questions like that. Is that cool? Guys excited about that?
Uh-huh.
All right, so I want to start with kind of what were your big takeaways as you guys went through Disciple with Bill. You sat with Yoda. You heard from Yoda. How was that settled over the last month? Oh, by the way, community group guy, so participation is required, right? Bill's going to be so sad. Come on, big takeaways. What do you guys got?
Well, I like the way he formulates all of his teaching around the image of God.
Mm-hmm.
Brings it back to that. Everything's filtered through that. Great way of thinking about it. Never heard it quite put that way so consistently.
Sure. Are you doing counseling at Bellevue?
No.
What stream are you coming up through? Are you coming up through community groups? Generic elder?
Through community groups, but also sort of leading the faith work integration ministry that we're going to begin over there.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's something we've been working on behind the scenes to get ready for.
Sure. How did that image of God stuff challenge just the way that, like, as you're thinking about being an elder, pastoring folks and shepherding them and discipling them, how did that challenge the way that you'd be doing that?
Well, it fits perfectly into the faith work integration in that that's one of the places that men and women typically don't think about imaging God.
Mm-hmm.
They don't consider how the gospel can inform sort of the smallest decisions to the biggest decisions in the workplace, and how that's how we're called to transform, reclaim work, restore work, redeem work, and be image bearers in the workplace. So it was a good way of thinking about that.
Cool.
Yeah.
Anybody else have any takeaways from Disciple?
I just always like the way he approaches it, each one of them say, and the way we distort that is,
yeah,
it's helpful for seeing, because in each one of those, you know, I can see examples of myself in my own group that stand out and go, okay, yeah, that's how we get off track, that's how we get away from it. And so it's always good to say, you know, just reviewing some notes from last time and remind myself, refresh myself on some of it. But the, you know, what happens when it's evangelism only? What happens when it's mercy only? What is, how do we get off those tracks? How do we keep it? How do we get it distorted? How is it just about gratification or autonomy? So just going back over those.
How understanding just even that thought process of image bearer of God and distortion, how do you think that will help you in a role as an elder?
Well, of course, the image, the distortion image that happens a lot is the good things I've done, the bad things I've done define me, as opposed to going back and finding my identity in Christ. So when they get either in a pity party or when they get people get into a bragging party, it's like, okay, let's get centered again. Let's yep. talk about that. Is that what you're looking for?
Yeah, I mean, for me, I don't know about you guys, and some of you as coaches and leaders and stuff, you're shepherding people.
Right.
And a lot of times when someone comes to you and they just start unloading, you know, it might just be, I'm going to vomit everything that I'm facing right now. Yeah. And it's really easy to get caught in the details yeah. of like what their struggle is. And what's helpful for me is as I'm listening for identity and I'm listening for distortion. Mm-hmm. And so it helps me in my ability to counsel, because I don't get, you know, I'm not like a cat who gets caught with a flashy toy or something, and I'm just like, oh, that's interesting. I'm able to kind of stay focused with where am I hearing that distortion, and how do I draw them back to understanding who they are and their identity in Christ. And so really important as you kind of, you know, hear what Bill's talking about in terms of being a disciple, but also make sure you're kind of putting that in your quiver for counseling and shepherding people, right? Because sometimes we're like, yeah, that was really cool. You know, I want to make sure that actually helps me tomorrow be a pastor, right?
I think for me, a lot of those things were really impactful. I agree what you say. But it made me think about those things more in my everyday life.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's easy to compartmentalize when we are sort of on, when we're in a counseling situation or talking with someone in community group, but then I've got people that I interact with at work, people I interact with on the street and everywhere else. Thinking about that and looking for those indicators in people's language, no matter where you are,
yep.
everywhere, because everybody has those distortions, myself included, and those identity issues, and it uncovers where our idols are and what kind of things trip us up. And so just be, I think it's good practice, and it's also, when we're as Christians, it's a loving thing to do, to be engaging with people, even that we don't really know on that kind of level, of showing concern for them in the way we ask questions and sort of understand where they're at, who they are.
Yeah. Helps you know, even if you don't say, hey, that's an idol.
Right.
But at least you understand where they're coming from, right?
Yeah, that's kind of the
not a good practice, by the way.
Kind of the background.
With people at work.
The background right. process of talking to someone.
Yeah, totally. Anything else you guys want to pipe in there that was specifically meaningful for you?
I think I wasn't here for Pastor Bill's talk here, but I went through, he did a retrain back in August. And what's been really helpful for me, and I haven't come out the other end yet, is thinking about how the discipleship piece impacts community specifically.
Mm-hmm.
And this may sound like a no-brainer, but the goal of community groups isn't community. The goal of community groups is discipleship and a growing relationship with Christ. And we'd all say that on paper, but in practice, I know at least I get distracted from that. It's like,
yep.
all right, how are we doing in community? Are we multiplying? And so really over the past several months, just thinking about the identity and the discipleship piece, where how am I doing as a disciple? Because if I'm not doing good as a disciple, I'm not going to be reproducing Christ's image.
which you've kind of covered in the book, as well as numbers, both being important, neither one to exclude one of the other, was the depth of the discipleship process that's going on in community, as well as how many are doing it.
Yeah, because that's the, because we can fall off that cliff, right?
Right.
We can just be like, hey, it's all about, you know, like just making disciples, really good, seven really good disciples,
yeah.
And being
yeah.
able to balance those things. But it is at the end of the day. I mean, what is the purpose of Marshall Church?
Disciples plant churches.
Make disciples plant churches. What's the goal of community? Make disciples plant churches.
Yeah.
I mean, it's not like it, like that's the Marshall Church is the community, right?
Yep.
Like it's not an entity apart from that. And so, really big deal. We'll talk about that a little bit in ownership. A really big deal because we do oftentimes compartmentalize that. We've got a goal in community, which is to get a bunch of people in it, but we have a church goal of making disciples and planting churches. And what that does is it separates the people from the goal of the church. They start forgetting that their goal is to make disciples and plant churches. And it's a really cool opportunity for us to really bring ownership to that when we understand, like, hey, this is all consistent from top down. This is what our goals are, right? So a question for you. One of the things that you were asked to do with Pastor Bill's homework was to look from, I don't know if he used these terms, but cradle to grave, the discipleship of from child to death, right? Is that one of the questions?
There's unbeliever to elder.
Yeah. Unbeliever to elder, cradle to grave, something like that, right?
Eldership is like death. So.
Yeah. The end of eldership.
Cool.
So as you guys were thinking through that, you had to write that out. If I were to bring you on at my campus, or you were an elder at my campus in Scranton, and I said, I want you to help me develop a discipleship ministry. I want to be able to disciple the people that come through Marshall Scranton. Help me brainstorm what the major components of a discipleship track or a discipleship ministry would be. Do y'all have a pen? I want you to write down what you think the three main components. Maybe you want to put four. I don't care. Three or four main components of a discipleship track would be that you'd want to put in place. And it doesn't have to be the way Pastor Brad put it in his book. You know, you don't have to stroke ego here. I want to know, when you're thinking through it, what do you think are the important components? How many read the book, by the way? Did we all read it? Worship guys down there. They're like, eh. For the recording, I'm just eating right now, so you can. Not that good.
Like all of them will not hear it.
How about you make them gift my book to 10 people? off of Amazon. I want my 50 cents. Okay, we got three. Are you guys there? Anyone need more time?
Depends on how detailed you want us to get.
Okay. One, two, three. We added another one. Put it up there. Okay, so what were you guys, is like when you think about important components to a discipleship plan or discipleship track, what do you got? What do you think?
Grounding their identity.
Okay, so grounded in their identity. When I say, maybe I should clarify this. When I say components, I mean basically how, like, I'm asking you to build a track for me so that someone's being discipled. So grounded in identity is a thing, but how do we ground them in their identity? Right. So, what are we going to use to do that? So what if you were building it, and so so this would be this equals gospel teaching. How would you accomplish that? Very important. How do we do it?
So you're saying a discipleship track at a church?
Yep.
But that's not a trick question, like the whole church. Because I mean, it could be like gospel teaching from the pulpit, since the whole church is about discipleship. But you are saying like a specific.
Yeah, I'm saying how, like, what, like, if you were saying, okay, this is how I take, this is how I take Joe, and this is what I want. This is how I'm thinking of, you know, Joe developing to an elder, or just growing in his discipleship. What are the components of that? Right. I mean, we do this all the time at the church. Okay, how are we building a discipleship track? I don't think it's a trick question, but I think it
helping them to develop a relationship with Jesus through the Word and prayer.
Okay. So we're still talking about conceptual ideas. We want, so grounded identity, worship, and prayer. We want to do those things. So what do we employ to do those things?
So, like, getting involved in the community.
So a community group. So community may be one of those components. Right. So a component would be community. A component could be a membership class. A component could be Christianity 101, learning how to study the Bible, like learning how to do prayer, right? Could be a midweek class, right?
Well, don't you, for number one, don't you start with preaching, or are you assuming preaching already?
One of the things that I wanted to do is get us the idea, and maybe, you know, maybe you guys are going to kill it, so this is not a big exercise, but one of the things that most guys forget when they're looking through, because I've sat in maybe 50 meetings on how do we build a discipleship track, and the thing that never goes up there is the hour a week. So way to go down. That we don't even consider the fact that the big part of the discipleship track at Morris Hill is the preaching of the Word.
They've been in enough bad churches.
Well, they may be. They've been in bad churches.
It's like air. If you get it, you think it's just always there.
Yeah, and the crazy thing with that is that when you take the maybe average or at least the immature member of Morris Hill, the most time they're going to spend in the Word in the entire week is right there. That's unfortunate, but that's the truth. And sometimes what we do is we say, so we said preaching in community. What we generally do is we say, okay, we need a discipleship track, which means we need some classes, we need some mentors, and whatever else that we kind of add into that mix, right? Seminars. And we add all these things up, and we forget that the two primary components of Morris Hill are the primary vehicle for discipleship at Morris Hill. Does that make sense? Mm-hmm. It's the preaching of the Word. They're hearing that every week, and they're living that out in community. And then there's other things that we might add to that, but to understand, like, there's an aspect where you don't have to add a ton to that if we do those two things super well, right? We don't have to create a whole nother ministry or a whole nother discipleship track that's outside of that. And if we do build a discipleship track, it certainly should include those two things. Does that make sense? Did you guys see the... we'll jump around here just a little bit, but did you guys see the... in the book, I talk about a little bit about teaching and how it gets done and how things get communicated. And I had that little normal curve. Did that make sense to you guys? Can I do that?
Normal curve.
Is it help? Do you want me to do it again, or do you guys all get it? Basically, the idea is, I'll just do it because why not? Basically, we talk about kind of number of people and maturity. And if you actually look at any population, you're measuring anything. It's just statistics which says that the average person of whatever you're measuring clumps at the middle, and then you have less people in the end. And some of you, if you got in trouble in high school on a bell curve, you know, this is the classic bell curve. Majority of people are at a C. Really good folks are at an A. Really bad folks are at an E or an F, depending on where you were in the country, right? Do you guys have E or S? Does that make sense? And so what that means is when we talk about maturity, and talk about the average maturity of any church, the majority of people are in the middle. And then you have a smaller group of people at a lower maturity and a smaller group of people at a higher maturity. And these folks are like your leaders. This is where your elders and leaders come from. That's that 10% of the people do 90% of the work kind of thing. And then over here, you've got new believers and non-believers, right? And, you know, so conversion may be somewhere on that, depending on how missional you are. But the idea is basically, like, when we're talking about how do we disciple people, to think through, if my goal is to disciple the majority of our folks, if you're at a campus of, what, say 2,000, kind of average from our show, we're all somewhere in there, maybe a little less, maybe a little more, you know, you might have 1,500 people that are in that that group of folks. If you're trying to disciple them through a class, and I'm not saying that classes are bad, I'm just saying if you're trying to disciple like the entire population through a class, and you can only get, this is kind of the math that I did in the book. You guys remember this or a couple? Yeah. But if you say I can get 200 people in a class, which is a huge win. It's very rare that even at Ballard we can get 200 people in one class, right? You just think of how many times you have to loop that class to get everyone to learn one thing, right? If you're like, I want to get them to understand worship. I want everyone in the church to understand worship. You have to run that class, 7.5 times. So if you ran it every quarter, it would take at least 2 years plus to get everyone to go through that. Does that make sense? But the area that actually hits this the most, it would be preaching or lectures, so preaching or a seminar, and community, because the majority of our folks are in community. Does that make sense? So when we're looking at, when you're developing anything for your campus, you're saying, okay, first think about who's my target audience. If it's these folks, then classes and one-on-one mentoring work really well. If it's these folks, classes and one-on-one work really well, right? But that's not a great strategy for discipling the majority of the church. Does that make sense? So what I wanted to do is kind of pull, as you're thinking through discipleship and how to disciple people from Bill's class, I wanted you to think through this of like, okay, why is community groups so important to what we do at Mars Hill? It's because it's really one of the few ways that we can actually disciple a population of 1,200 people, or not 1,200, what are we, 12,000? Where are we at? 12,000, yeah, get my numbers right. 12,000 people. The way that we're going to be able to do that effectively is going to be through the preaching of the word and through people living that out in community. Is that helpful? Think it through? So a big deal when it comes to kind of a big picture of, like, I think as Rapucci said, we're trying to make disciples and understand that that's the ultimate goal for everything we do at Morris Hill. If you've done this exercise with me before, I apologize. Don't cheat. But if I were to ask you why we do community, like, what's the purpose, like, what's the motivation? We get that we want to make disciples, that's what we're doing. But when it comes to actually calling people from the pulpit, calling people that you meet on Sunday at prayer, talking with people around Mars Hill, what are the reasons that we give for getting into a community group?
That are given from the pulpit, or what are the reasons?
What are the reasons that you give? What are the reasons that you've heard from the pulpit? What are the reasons that we try to get people connected into groups?
It's where we do life together.
Okay. So, do life. Together?
Can't image God by yourself.
Okay, so, to image God?
Yeah.
So when the college kids come up and they say, why should I get in a community group? Your first one is to image God.
It's in there.
Okay. I'm not looking for school answers, people.
Yeah, I think the vast majority is all the things you're going to get out of it, like relationships and meals, and that tends to be what most of us, even just like the whole concept of doing life together, like you're going to, this great family environment. This is where we get to know one another and invest in one another.
Sure. So relationships. What other things do we give? Or do we
study the word?
Study. What else?
Shepherding.
Shepherding.
Taking care of one another.
Ben says. Okay. On mission. What else?
To know each other.
So, to be known. Big church feel small,
right?
They're kind of the big, small, get connected or known. Anything else?
Accountability.
So, when I hear, sometimes I hear from the pulpit, sometimes I hear just leaders talking to new folks or new people. Sometimes I hear it come out of my own mouth. I hear three different categories of the reason that we give people to get connected, right? And so there's a why, there's a what, and there's a for. So we either actually give them a why, right? And maybe image God fits in this one, maybe not. But we either give them, like, this is why we have to do it. Or we give them, this is what we do. Or we give them, this is what we get out of it, right? This is the four. So this might be, as we talked about earlier, this might be to make disciples, right? That's why we're doing it. If we look at the four, and we do this all the time, right? Is that we're trying to meet them at their need, and say, this is what you feel disconnected. But get in a community group because that's where we get connected. That's where life happens. That's where we get relationships. What's the problem with selling people on the idea of community based on four?
That might not happen.
What happens when it doesn't happen?
Really?
pissed off sheep.
They get pissed off, maybe.
Yeah. They leave, they don't come back.
Frustrated.
They don't come back, they're frustrated. Because they feel like you sold me something and it didn't happen, right? Which of these do you think is the easiest one to try, that you go to most naturally when you're telling people about community? The four tends to be the easiest one, right?
So the benefits.
Yeah, because it's like, here, like, and why do you think that is? Why do you think that we go to the benefits of community?
I try to kill it in flesh without realizing it, I guess, in a sense.
Yeah, I mean, we really do. We appeal to the flesh. We even, in a lot of cases, we might be appealing to idols in people's lives, right? Like even, you know, big church, small, like one of my idols is that, you know, only small churches are godly. So if you can make this big one feel small, then that's right. Like, it's really easy to go there because not just that we're appealing to the flesh, but why do we appeal to the flesh? Why do you think we do?
When that's where we're living, I think.
Sure.
In the flesh.
We're living in the flesh. We live in a culture that every appeal is made to the flesh, right? We're used to that, that's how we sell things. We sell things based on the flesh. And so what happens is that we end up conforming to the pattern of the world, and then we sell people and getting in community so that they get all these great things. We all know that we have communities filled with sinners, and so some of these things don't actually come to fruition. And now you have people that say, hey, they told me if I got into community, it would change my life. It didn't. And so now, you know, I'll go find some other ministry or something else to be part of, right? And so it's really big. It's really important for us to understand that's not a really good sell for why we do community. Okay. So the other category that we go to a lot of time is just we just tell them what this is what we do. We study the Bible and we do life together. We serve one another. We eat together, which you know is actually it probably appeals to both. Our mission, we worship, repentance. So what are the pitfalls of selling people on the what, do you think?
It's a works-based sort of thing that you're teaching. You're saying you need to do these things, so go here.
Yeah, community is a thing you do.
Yeah.
Right? And this is where we do it, so go do that. What happens, maybe this has happened for you guys before, you know, you send someone to a community group and it doesn't do that week. You guys have any issues with that in your groups?
Yeah. Or a new person comes on one of the weeks you're not doing the Bible teaching.
Yeah, like I'm going to another group. Why? Because you guys didn't study the Bible. I'm like, well, we didn't study by that week. We talked about the Bible a lot. We used the Bible, but maybe we didn't. But what we end up is we're setting them up to, like you're saying, works-based, and we're also setting them up, if it doesn't happen the way that we sold it, then all of a sudden we've lost them, right? Very important. And so when it comes to the why, what are the right whys?
Make disciples and plant churches.
Even making disciples and plant churches is still a four. It's the purpose. It's what we do, right? It's we make disciples and plant churches. But what makes community possible? And this you should have gotten in the first chapter of the book, right?
Who God is.
Who God is and what Christ has done, right? Everything that we do at Mars Hill, including the reason why we do community, has to be rooted in Jesus and what he's done. And what happens is we know that theologically, and then when we get into a place where we're actually calling people to community, we call based on these things, right? And so what we've done is we've taken what should have been practical theology and we've gone to pragmatism in order to get people to fill a ministry rather than really trust the rootedness of the gospel and what Jesus has done. Does that make sense? And that kills us because people get they don't get the experience they want, right? Have you ever heard this, especially the community group guys? Why aren't you in community? Well, I was in a group and I wasn't fed. Right? So what was happening is they were sold on an idea that community is about you and what you get. And when they didn't get what they wanted, they moved on. Right? But if we understand that community is about what Jesus did, and community is our opportunity to communicate and to live out and to be an example of the gospel, then it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter so much if I was fed. It matters, am I participating? Am I participating in community that reflects Christ? Am I reflecting, as we talked about, an image bearer of God? Am I being an image bearer within the community of God? Am I on mission with what God has called us to? Does that make sense?
So it fits kind of more to the initiate and respond kind of situation.
How so?
God initiates, so community groups is more of a response.
Totally. And that's what community should be. It should be a response to what Christ has done. Because when we look at the importance of the gospel when it comes to community is that we've been reconciled to God and we've been reconciled to one another, right? And so when we actually gather, and I talk about this in the book, when we gather in a community, it's a proclamation of the truth of the gospel and what the gospel's actually done. So just the fact that we're able to come, all of us in different walks of life, and we come together and we live life together, people see that, and it's telling them something different about our God and the God we serve, right? The fact that we don't sin against each other, but we do sin against each other, and we confess sin, and we repent of sin, and we forgive one another, is a proclamation of the grace of God. And that's something that they can't see just because I tell them that my life is different, right? They see it when they see the community of God. I think it's really important to understand, like, community groups are not just something that we do amongst a bunch of other ministries that we do at Morris Hill, but to understand that God has always used community as the technology, if you will, to proclaim the truth of who He is, right? From Adam and Eve, go there, multiply, be fruitful, multiply, and fill the earth as image bearers to proclaim who I am. Israel, a holy nation set apart to proclaim the truth of who God is, right? The church, again, holy nation set apart, people of His own possession, so that the world may know that you are my disciples, right? And so it's really important that we understand that, because as we're calling people to community, if they're doing it because of what Christ did, they'll still get all the fruit, but the fruit will be exactly what it is, which is it's the result of gospel-centered community. It's not going to become the idol and the thing that we have to have in order for community to be good for us. Does that make sense?
Let me go back to your bell curve.
Sure.
Let's say, it seems to me that where a person is on that curve.
Or what?
Where a person stands on that curve from non-believer to elder.
Sure.
Has some determination on what we need to emphasize for them, or what we need to make sure that they're getting.
Sure.
So while the why is always the why, always the why. If you take a person on the beginning part of that, and they're at a group that isn't giving some of the key things that they need to move them along.
Mm-hmm.
Isn't it important to make sure that, I would tend to counsel a person that's in a group that's not emphasizing, let's say, Bible study or something along those lines, in order to make sure they get to the point where they can actually see the whys.
Mm-hmm.
Does that make sense? I mean, I guess what I'm saying is that it's awesome that we aim for perfect community groups, that all those kinds of things are happening.
Mm-hmm.
There are no distortions in the way we do community. But if you're talking to a person, I'm talking on a micro level now,
sure,
where a person's at a group that says, I got to find another group. Why? Well, there's a lot of, I'm a relatively new Christian, so there's sure a lot, we do a lot of life together, but they really don't emphasize a sermon discussion in there, and I really have a thirst for knowing more.
That's actually a great example. Can I throw that out?
Yeah.
To everybody? Okay, so you got an individual, a new believing Christian. They're in a group that's doing maybe a lot of social stuff together. They're hanging out together, maybe even engaging culture together. But they feel like they're not learning or growing. So what do you counsel them to do? Or what's your next step as a pastor? sure part of being a disciple is being a disciple maker, so not assuming that the most, that the only thing that you need is for someone to mentor you, right? Maybe? Get that? Do you think the best course of action is to remove them from the current group?
No.
Why not?
Maybe.
More?
Could be, but I think I would ask them some more questions, like what are their expectations?
Sure.
Share the gospel with them, and that we are united in Christ, and that we are one body. We need you. We want you to be a part of what's going on. And then find out more what's going on in the community group.
Yeah, what if they're absolutely right?
I'd definitely talk to the leader and say, hey, man, what's going on here? These people need growth in Christ. You're just socializing. I'd ask him more questions to figure out what's going on, and then help him tweak it.
Yeah, because that would be my response, which is that's an awesome teaching moment for that entire community, right? And what people do naturally is they self-select and they say, well, my group's not doing X, so I'm going to go find a group that does X. And what that means is they, you know, say it's like, my group's not missional, so I'm going to go find a group that is. What that means is that individual now finds a group that's missional and they get on mission, but the old group never does, right? Rather than being able to say, hey, this is a teaching moment to take this whole group and mature it. Right, so when I draw the curve and it's new and non-believers, I believe there are really good reasons right there to have classes and have mentoring set up, and you should do that. There are some people in the middle that it's going to be, hey, if our group is missing something, the goal is I get asked all the time, and we're going to talk about this might give away an answer to one of the case studies, but I get asked that all the time. Hey, it's time for me to leave, you know, this group. And I don't think I've ever told anyone yes. Like, no, let's go get messy with that group and let's figure it out. Because if this is our primary vehicle for discipleship, not our only vehicle, not exclusive, the only vehicle that we have, but if it's our primary one, then we want to take every opportunity that we have to make sure the whole community is affected and grows and changes, right? Yeah. That helpful?
So then you go about re-engineering the group.
So I would go and I would talk with the leader and I would say, hey, did you know that Jim's dying on the vine? Did you know that? What do you think you could do? Or what do you think the community could do to make sure that you don't just have a bunch of social things going on? And I would work with that leader, right? Generally, I'd probably take it to the coach and give it to him to own and take, but that's, you know, that's the direction I would go. Any other thoughts or questions on kind of the why stuff? Generally, two components of why. Someone said, because that's what we're designed for. Whoops, lost that. And we talked about modeling Jesus, and I kind of brought it to, you know, this is what Jesus did. He died and resurrected, right? So I think there's two components, and I talk about this a little bit. And then there's one, there's the word designed in the image of a Trinitarian God that exists in community, and we're called image bearers. We're supposed to reflect that image of God, including his Trinitarian nature. And so we're designed to be in community. We don't function well outside of community. Anybody watch Lock Up? You guys don't watch Lock Up on MSNBC? I had to get rid of cable for a while because I kept watching that. It's like, do we have a nod, anyone? They do it's like a reality show inside prisons. And it's like they just go around with cameras and they interview these like crazy guys. What is the hardest form of punishment in a maximum security prison?
Solitary
confinement, man. And you watch those videos, I mean, they start painting the walls with feces. Like, they snap. You got a psychologist, right? Like, what is the effect of, do you want to answer that question? What is the effect of isolation for the human mind?
Well, I actually still evaluate them when they come out of there, because they actually, a lot of are able to apply for social security disability because PTSD is so severe. Whether they're schizophrenia or they're bipolar or whatever it is that they went in with, about 10 times worse than it was when they come out. And so they actually, a lot of them qualify, because they to go to work would be, they would just
Yeah, I mean, the human, we're just not designed that way, right?
Yeah.
But what I hear often in the pitch to get into community, as I hear the pitch that says, because you were designed in the image of a Trinitarian God, you should be in community. Is that true? It is true. What is that on a scale of from law to grace? What do you think that communicates?
Law,
right? Because it's a should. You have to do this because the image bearer of God. But we live in a fallen world, right? So sin makes it almost impossible, if not completely impossible, for us to exist in that kind of community, right? And so we tell people, hey, because God exists in community, you should and you have to. And then what we've done is we said, you're saved by grace. You know, first you're saved under the law and you can't do it. So Christ comes and we're saved by grace. And now we're going to give you a new law that says, you know, what Christians really do is they live in community because that's who God is. And so we've just replaced law with law. And you've probably heard all this from Justin in a much more articulate way, but we do the same thing when it comes to community. And that's why I put such an emphasis when I'm talking about in the book and when I talk with people, is that you have to understand that the purpose and the reason why we're in community is because of what Christ has done. Because it's in his death, in his resurrection, that he conquers Satan, sin, and death, and he reconciles us to himself and to one another. It's only possible because of Christ. And so while everyone's created in the image of God, while everyone needs community, there is no way to actually experience that type of community apart from that reconciliation. And that's why community is so huge in our ability to reach the cities and the places that we live, right? Because everybody feels it, whether they're in isolation in a prison or whether they're just in isolation in their cube. And they have relational connections with people, but it's always void apart from... There's always a void there apart from the reconciling work of Christ. He says it in 2 Peter when he says, once you were not a people, but now you are a people. To me, that speaks directly to that idea of even though I was in a family, even though I had friends, I was not a people apart from what Christ has done in my life. Right? That makes sense? I think that's huge for us and understanding why we do community, because I think the pitches that we often make suck. And what we end up doing is we exchange the gospel and the truth and the power of the gospel for some flimsy pitch of meet your need, right? And so I just want to make sure we don't do that. Cool?
Yeah. It's really powerful, actually. You're dissecting that out.
So as you guys are leading people, I don't want you to make that exchange, right? As you're leading at your campus, as you're an elder, and you're thinking through why we do this stuff. That's why when we talk about, I draw that picture in the book, kind of Sunday and community. I don't know if you remember that picture of what we do,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
And it's that 1-2 punch. It's like we go to Sunday, proclamation of the word. We take communion, we worship God. That brings about conviction. As we go into community, that conviction is being worked out into confession and repentance, so there's actually transformation occurring in our life. And if we're missing community, then we're stuck in worldly sorrow. If we're missing the proclamation of the word, we're generally missing conviction about that. And so that's the 1-2 punch of Mars Hill. When you look at our distinctives, Sunday services and community, right? The other ministries that we have are valuable ministries. I'm the director of ministry development, which means like women's ministry and redemption groups and music. They all fall under my leadership at the central level, and they're all very important. But what they do is they all support this, right? Redemption group ministries is to help people that are stuck to get them back in community and living in that the highway model that Pastor Mike talks about, living on the highway, right? Children's ministry is to make sure that it's connected to what, you know, mom and dad are doing, that they're hearing the same thing so that they can live in community together and they can go to services together and live that out, right? Music ministry is about making sure that we're leading people in worship and making sure that Sunday is the best thing that it can be, and also providing material for people to worship throughout the week. That's why we record songs and make albums, so that it's not just an event, but it draws it all out into the community, right? I don't know if you agree. Is that accurate?
Oh, yeah.
By the way, yeah, great job with that.
Thanks.
Heard it just hit, and it's going well. So that's really important for us to understand, even when we're thinking through a ministry that we might be championing, to understand, okay, like, it's not about my little individual thing, right? It's about how does this work and play out so that there's actually synergy, right? Synergy between the ministries that we do from Sunday to life in community. And if we talk about women's ministry, that it works together with those two things. If we talk about something like social mercy, that we're doing those things so that it complements what's already happening, not that it becomes a thing unto itself. Make sense? So that's my spiel for you guys as high-level leaders. You've read the majority of how we do this and how this gets rolled out at Mars Hill. When do we have to stop, Tyler?
Whenever we go down.
So
a lot of 6 to 9.
What's that?
We a lot of 6.
From 6 to 9. So what I have left is basically time for questions regarding kind of how all that stuff gets worked out. If there's anything else you guys want to talk about, boot camps, the structure of community groups and the importance of that. Spaces and rhythms, which I've done boot camps at most of your campuses, but you may or may not have been there, and you might want to explore some of that more. How do we encourage ownership? Questions on any of those things or anything else that you saw in the book or other stuff that you've seen, we can go through that, and then we can do some case studies. It's 7 o'clock, so we're an hour in. You guys want to do some Q&A? Oh, sorry, if you come late.
I'm late. You're that guy.
In terms of the fruit that you are seeing in community groups, like it seems like, well, I was wondering, do you find that consistently, like, seeing those, like people being on mission and they're and like really serving their neighborhood, you see that as like consistently like probably one of the fruit of the group that's lacking mostly in groups? Like is that a little bit.
Yeah, I would say that when we talk about making disciples, Bill doesn't draw this picture anymore, but I think it's always been really helpful for me, which is, it's about making a disciple. We start with our identity in Christ, that leads to worship, community, and mission, right? And we call all of this the image of God. So if I was to summarize this book, like that's how it summarizes in my head in pictures. And so when I'm talking to people about what does a community group look like, if you take a bunch of musicians and you put them in a group together, you don't get a basketball player coming out the other end, right? Our basketball team. You get a band, right?
Yeah.
Unless you have really tall musicians. But if you take a bunch of disciples, and we really are forming disciples in this way, and you put them all together in a community, then the expressions of the individuals should also come out in the expression of the community itself, right? It's the idea, like when we talk about nature versus nurture, right? And, you know, the old argument, well, you know, we're all good and we're nurtured through culture to do bad things, but the reality is that at the end of the day, we're the ones that make culture, right? It has to come back to that. It had to be a reflection of who we are. Culture is simply a reflection of the people in it. Society is just a reflection of us, right? And so if the culture within community is someone who's worshiping God in community, on mission, all coming out of their identity in Christ, then I should see those expressions in the community itself, right? And so, this is kind of a rabbit trail, but if we distort this way, what do we end up with? If that's all we do, identity and worship.
Kind of like an emotionally based experience where you're like, more focused on
Well, what I would say, like, you actually took it to the place of just worship, the kind of worship experience. When I was thinking worship, I'm thinking, like, we're in the Word, we love Jesus, Bible, and worship Jesus, that's what we do, right? And so generally when I see that distortion, it comes out in a Bible study. It's like us, we're all Christians, our identity is in Christ, and we study the Bible because we love God, right? If it distorts this way, we end up with kind of a care group. It's like it's about community, and we're Christians, and it becomes like kind of the holy ghetto. And that's, we end up with closed groups, and no one ever gets saved. I generally don't see this so much as I see this, which is the emergent church, right? Which is, we're on mission, but we actually don't tie it back to Christ in any meaningful way. Like, we're smoking hookahs, but we're not necessarily seeing anyone converted. That might be a straw man, but that's what I see. And so our expectation is we want to see a community that's reflecting all of it, because, like, the issue is that we cannot be the most missional church in America if our people are not missional, right? It's just a bunch of bull, you know, and that was the revelation for me. That was the impetus for this book, and the way we do community at Mars Hill is that at some point it just looked like everyone was just watching Mark. And Mark was missional. I believe the elders were missional, but the people of Mars Hill weren't. They were just watching. And so that's where we kind of put that, really kind of try to call people to this and help them see how to do that. And I think we've made progress, but to your point, this is a long answer for a short question, but our biggest struggle at Mars Hill, and any church I've ever been to, is calling people to own that part. So we end up distorting more here, where we're into the Bible and we're into each other, but including non-believers and getting involved in engaging culture is our hardest. It's kind of our hardest nut to crack. And so if you look at the book, 50% of the book is on cracking that nut, right? All I do is explain what community is. I don't even get into a lot of the community and the Bible study portion of it, because the majority of people are there. They're like, yeah, that's what we think community is. Calling them to engagement in cultures is huge. So that's where we lack the most, and that's where we cannot let up. And the crazy thing is this, is that, so I'm saying this is what we should look like, right? And which can take us to law, which says if you're not on mission, you know, get on mission. Why? Because we have to, because that's what disciples do. Rather than understanding that it's an invitation, it's a gift. I mean, it's crazy. It's crazy that we get to be a part of what God's doing. We had 1,200 baptisms over this year so far, right? Of those, I've listened to tons and tons of testimonies, and every one of them, there's a component of community that's been a part of those people coming to know Christ. Either they heard the message from Mark and they got connected to a community group and now they're getting baptized, or they got invited into a community group and they, you know, heard the gospel and they started coming Sunday and they got baptized. It's amazing, you know. And it's, we're inviting people. We're not saying you have to. We're just like, hey, God has invited us in, and just like He's given us the gifts of Scripture so that we can know who He is, just like He's given us the gift of prayer so that we can commune and talk with Him, He's given us community so we can be sanctified and we can participate in the mission of God. It's a gift, right? And so we want to invite people into that, and we got to constantly not only invite them, but show them it's not that hard, right? Like, it's simple things. But we got to keep pressing and pressing, because we're in an individualistic culture that says it's not about your brother or your neighbor. It's about you and making sure you're happy. And so we're fighting not just apathy. We're fighting a culture that says, you know, don't mess with anybody, right?
Yeah, the community group that I'm a part of has elements of all of that going on. And it's really interesting to start noticing. I don't know if this is normal in a group, but there's different people that have different proclivities, and I constantly have to, like, reinforce image all over and over, because some people want to just hang out, some people want to just do a Bible study, and some people just want to go out in the community and engage. Mm-hmm. It's like a consistent thing. We even replicating, you can sort of see in our replication.
Who wants to go where?
Like, who wants to go where? And I have to continually call those leaders to the other things that they're not as, don't have as much of a proclivity towards.
And that's the beauty of like of Bill's teaching, right? Is that you're able to start to see not just the positive but the distortions, and then like when we really can equip leaders with understanding the discipleship pieces and the image of God and how those things work out and get distorted, then instead of just watching their group kind of distort, you can start shepherding them back to, you know, a healthy picture of a community of disciples, right?
So let me ask about the mission piece then in that sense, and taking it back to, you just came back, Holcomb's talking on a mission in the first, where the picture that I remember is the cascading of the water into increasingly large concentric pools,
mm-hmm.
right? So mission is about the email he needed to send to his father-in-law,
mm-hmm.
right? As opposed to where I think we tend to say it's about serving at the homeless shelter this weekend.
Yeah.
Right? So can you speak to that into what...
Yeah, one of the things I would say, kind of what I think one of the distortions of the past decade, or probably more decade, maybe three decades. When did we come out with the laws, the four spiritual laws?
Well, that was in the 60s, right?
60s? How many? Five decades?
Yeah.
Half a century? One of the things that I think that the church has done is that they've relegated evangelism to individuals, right? But when you look at Scripture, and we look at 1 Peter 2, and it talks about this is the community of God, and this is what the community of God looks like. And at the end of that, you see this concept that those that spoke evil against you will give glory to God on the day of visitation, right? That this whole picture of the community, from the idea that their identity is, he starts with their identity, that their identity is rooted in Christ, so that they would worship, proclaim the excellencies of the one who saved them, so that they could live in community, even in the concept of keeping your reputation among the Gentiles honorable, right? That's in the sense of community. It's not an individual keeping their reputation honorable. It's the whole community, so that they would give glory to God on the day of visitation. So the purpose of the community is to reflect what Christ has done, so that those that even speak evil against you will come to know Jesus, right? The new commandment, Jesus says, love one another just as I have loved you. Love one another so that the world would know that you are my disciples. Right? So the purpose of love, the purpose of loving one another as a community, is not so that you would be loved. It's so that non-believers would see and come to know Jesus. Right? And so when we talk about mission...
I just don't see the lack of individual focus in that statement, that love one another. So that's a commandment to me, to love him, so that other people see that. And sure, if the Christian community is made... I mean, that's the culture, is made mm-hmm. of the individuals doing that thing.
Okay, so,
others, right?
great question. So, what I want you to do is, without any community, so without talking to Cam, love one another for me.
Oh no, I have to love him.
Yeah, there has to be a community so that I can love one another. Bill gave me this one, but when we talk about the fruits of the Spirit, the majority of the fruits of the Spirit cannot even be displayed apart from another person, not even just another person in community, but someone who's probably being a jerk. Long suffering, patience, right? You can't even do the fruits of the Spirit apart from community. So you can't, and so those things that are supposed to image God and reflect who God is to other people, in Scripture, when you actually look at where is evangelism happening, maybe not in every case, but the majority of the cases that I see it, it's happening in a body of people.
Well, I guess I would contend with the statement that you can't exhibit the fruits.
I'm saying that there are many of the fruits of the Spirit that you cannot display.
Rick goes away, goes to a place where no one's ever heard of Jesus.
Uh-huh.
I can, long-suffering, I can display long-suffering.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Patience, kindness, I can display all those to without a Christian community.
You need a person, though.
I need a person, but I don't need other Christians. Right?
You need community. I should say that I'm not defining community as, even when we talk about this, community is not just Christians. It's not just Mars Hill. Community is people in general. An individual, apart from other people, has a really hard time doing a lot of those things. And so, what I don't know if that answers the question, but like, we really do have to think. I mean, even the idea, when we talk about evangelism, talking to a non-believer, right? And you say, you need to meet Jesus. Why? Because he's changed my life. In this culture, it doesn't mean anything, right? Show me. How does it change your life? Right? And they don't want to hear words. They want to see it. And that's what I don't think that that's much different than it's ever been. I think there are certainly places where an individual just proclaiming the truth of God and who he is, someone's going to come to know Jesus. That can totally happen. But I think there's a reason why God said God has used community as that vehicle to show, like Israel, you're supposed to be different.
I'm just trying to balance this, and I'm not trying to be argumentative, but trying to balance it. And the picture I would give again is Holcomb, whose dad was sitting on a beach. A preacher came by and said, "Do you know Jesus?" He goes, "No, you want to?" He goes, "Yeah."
No, I would say that's individual evangelism.
Yeah.
I would say that that's one aspect of evangelism, but that's not. I don't even know if that's the primary way. I probably can't make that statement that it's not the primary way. But I would say even the examples I see in Scripture, I see God changing a people, transforming a people, so that those who see it know that there's something different about God, not about that individual.
And the only reason I keep pressing on this is that it seems like, my mind, I'm getting a mixed message from Holcomb's discussion on mission to what we're talking about being missionless community group. It seems like it started with a call to be on mission, as seeing yourself on mission as you're going through life each day, the people you're in touch with and interacting with, as opposed to organizing your community group to go do social activities in the neighborhood.
I would say there's an aspect of both,
okay.
And I would say that when community is an event, it's really easy to separate those two things, right?
Okay.
If I go to community on Tuesday night, and then I'm evangelistic for the rest of my days, rather than I live life with a bunch of people. So when I make a connection with someone as an individual, I bring them into this community, so that they can see how I interact with other people, right? And so I bring those two things together. So I certainly wouldn't say, hey, don't be individualistically evangelistic. I would say, yeah, you should be having those conversations, but know that a lot of times the deal's going to be sealed as God uses the community to show what happens when he interjects into life, right? And I think we've kind of been in a culture where it's a lot easier to just grab onto the individualistic one, because it's a little bit more work to actually, like, because if I do that in community, then what do I have to do? I have to confess sin to people I sin against. I have to forgive people who sin against me. That's hard work. The gospel has to do a work there. Whereas an individual, frankly, I can tell the guy anything I want. I can make it sound better than it is. I'm sure that the majority of us have lied for the sake of the gospel to somebody we're trying to seal, right? Oh no, like my life's totally different. It's great. Well,
which is why I really don't generally believe it.
Exactly. Exactly.
It's not all that different.
And so it's like you bring it into community and you're like, well, yeah, it's not as clean as you think it would be, but you know, watch for a while and tell me if you see a different people. And I think God uses that a lot. So,
I like that diagram that you drew, that IWMC. But it seems like, just to be honest, I guess. Like if you took a bunch of those and made the diagram out of a whole bunch of those, like you got individuals imaging God in community, worshiping on mission in a community of others.
Yeah, that's why I didn't draw it that way.
It would take you forever.
Well, you're also killing the metaphor, yeah.
I was just thinking that when we're talking about this idea of individual
That's what happens, right? That's what happens is you have a bunch of people, you know, you got disciple, and you know what we become is a gathering of disciples. We become a gathering of disciples rather than that we're actually a community that are there is an actual collective identity, right? When you look at 1 Peter 2, it says you're a priesthood, a holy nation. Man, help me out here. What are the other? A chosen people, right? It's all corporate identity, plural, not individuals, right? It's not like you're a bunch of priests. It's like you're a priesthood, right? You're a nation, you know? And we've lost all sense of corporate identity, and we just think of ourselves as individual disciples rather than, I mean, it doesn't take much to, like, you can look in Revelation, seven churches of Revelation. Jesus would get in trouble for generalizing a little bit, don't you think? Like, the Holy Spirit inspiring Revelation through John, and it's like, don't you think you're generalizing to say everybody from Ephesus, you know, lost their first love? You know, Old Testament, right? Did you think you might be generalizing a little bit with Sodom and Gomorrah? Like, is everybody, you know, wicked and despicable? But there is a corporate identity, right? So, I might get in trouble. Justin's not here, right? Give me my theology there. But I think it makes sense. Like, there's pushback there because it's like, we don't generally think that way. And our people don't either. So, like, really calling them to, like, we are all in this together, right? There isn't a mission of Mars Hill that is Marx. There's a mission that is ours. Like, we're all on this. We're all Mars Hill. So, questions? Anything else? Spaces, rhythms, why we do neighborhoods, structures.
We do an affinity-based group that is also, just because we're in a neighborhood, has become also a neighborhood group, and it's pretty awesome.
You lucked out, otherwise the law would be coming down. Just kidding.
No, it's interesting. So that we're in Pioneer Square, and there's tons of artists that are there, and we're kind of an artist affinity-based group, and yet we have guys from UGM that come every week, other people in the neighborhood that
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. Now that's the thing, is like our primary organization is through neighborhoods. We want to be geographic because for the majority of people, they don't. You know, we talk about this idea of even like being missional at the workplace, right? And we talk back to this evangelism concept. Most of the people I talk to use that as an excuse to do nothing. Well, I'm missional. My mission field is my workplace. Well, what do you do there? I have a fish on my cube. I pray before my meals. You know, and you're like, okay, like, you're carrying your cross out to the workplace, I guess. But, like, for most folks, just giving them something more to own, right? Like, to be able to see very clearly. You drive by people that are dying and dead in their sin, and you may be the only person that they know that could share the gospel with you, right? And really giving people the accessibility to this larger mission of Mars Hill, to me, is really huge. And there may be times when you gather people based on affinity because it has a better chance of reaching non-believers. And as long as that's the case, I'm okay with doing, once in a while, doing affinity-based groups because it has a chance to reach people. Affinity-based groups that are so I can be around a bunch of me's, I'll kill that every time, right? And you know that. I mean, we've worked through that stuff. Okay, what makes this missional? How do you keep it missional? How do you make sure it doesn't become a club? And if they can't answer that question, then hey, why don't we blow this up and let's just go neighborhood, right? Because at least there, you know, there's non-believers, and it's very clear who you're trying to reach. Cool. Want to do some case studies, or you guys want to go home? I'm told we have till 9. So. Want to do some case studies?
Yeah.
That's my wife asking when I'm coming home.
Well, there you go. Let's wrap it up.
Let's wrap it up. What's that? Say a case study. So you're asked to teach, and your wife wants you to come home. So what do you do? So, case study one is just based on kind of question of ownership. So, you guys, you're leading you're on a leadership team at a campus. You've set some goals for February. You need to plant 10 new groups, and you don't have any current apprentices. So you decide to make a call from the stage on Sunday to recruit new leaders. What is your training strategy? So maybe I'll give you, would it help if I just give you three and then we can walk through them? So how about I give kind of maybe the two extremes. One is that you send them all through the apprentice process in groups. Two, you set up a 6 to 8 week training course, right, that you teach. So what are the implications in those three areas, quality control, ownership, and time? I said I just had to go with two, and then we'll talk. If there's a third option, we'll going through three options with all this would take forever. So number one, apprentice in groups. What are the implications for quality control?
They're good. You can see people in community. You can have them actually do something. See what their effect is on the group. You can get a read back from a lot of people and see. Follow them or not.
So you get good feedback of like you've got somebody on the job doing the work, so or doing the leading, so you can actually see them. Okay.
I would argue also that in another sense it's not great quality control because they're hearing potentially different things from however many leaders you're spreading them out towards, right? They're not hearing the same consistent message necessarily because there's always different people that responsible for training an individual person.
So if you have a campus of 140 groups, you might have 140 evaluators.
Yeah.
Which means you don't have consistency.
140 different messages.
Sure. Any other thoughts? Because both are true. There's advantages and there's disadvantages to quality control. Or the leader doesn't follow up, and you've got to manage each one of those relationships to make sure that the leader's actually apprenticing the person, right? So it's easy for someone to fall through, or it's easy for someone to do nothing and still get approved.
Right.
Yeah. What about ownership? Is that increase or decrease ownership?
It increases if you're the leaders who are having to group disciple a bunch of guys.
Yeah, because now the training only gets done if the leaders do it, right? That's a high ownership, very positive thing. Just a caveat on ownership. I think this is anecdotally true, and I'm sure someone could argue with me that it's not, but I think that every decision that you make in the way that you build ministry and the way that you lead folks has an effect on ownership. It's either going to increase it or decrease it. It's very seldom that you can do something that's neutral, right? So as I've been leading stuff, it's like, okay, how we decide to train. Is either going to increase or decrease ownership. How I communicate, how we do a capital campaign that we're doing right now could increase or decrease ownership for our leaders and our community groups in that process. Like, there's a lot of decisions that we can make, and the way that we lead folks, do you guys get what I mean by that?
Yeah.
We're either putting responsibility on folks, or we're taking responsibility away. And the majority of the time, when we take responsibility away, it decreases ownership because they're like, I don't have to do it. And when we put responsibility on, it increases ownership because there's something to do.
Whose ownership are you talking about?
I'm talking about the community group leaders and coaches and head coaches. Existing.
You're not talking about the apprentices.
No, I'm talking, like right now, I'm talking about, when we talk about ownership, we're talking about ownership of the leaders in your ministry. And so when we talk about this, and we say, if we do this one, we increase ownership because it's their responsibility, yeah. You're not doing it for them.
Well, and that's a split hairs. So if I'm understanding the case study correctly, so basically, did a call from stage, and we get 10 people say, all right, I want to do it. So then we're sending those 10 people out to apprentice in
10 different groups.
Yeah. 10 different groups. So a potential ownership problem, because ideally we want the groups to be raising up apprentices and taking ownership of the multiplication.
Mm-hmm.
So a potential ownership problem then is, if we're calling apprentices...
By choosing to make a call, that could have a negative impact on ownership.
For the, yeah. The groups.
Luckily, we're only talking about the training piece. But that's exactly the point, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
Is that if you say, hey, you guys just aren't getting it done, so I'm going to go make a call from the front, then they can say, well, if we ever get behind, they're going to make a call from the front. So it does happen. It's
yeah.
Good catch. So ownership we see... mostly positive by having it go, doing number one. And then what about time? What's that?
Time goes up.
Time goes up. It hinders it because now it's a organic process by which you gotta see it. And depending on how many meetings you have a week, we haven't really got into rhythm. So I'm assuming you guys all know my feelings on rhythm. So you might have a few more opportunities to see them. But
I think it could decrease. I mean, I think that's another plus minus thing. Because you've got someone on a course, you know, at the end of that, just comparing it to a course, at the end of the course, you don't necessarily know. I mean, I would be surprised to let someone start a group after a training course and nothing else, you know, no apprenticeship process at all. So it seems like just starting it in apprentice. You know, some people, if you've got John Piper and he comes to your group and he's your apprentice, like, you may just be able to let him go right away.
Maybe.
He's probably going to land right here.
Yeah. Just kidding. Love, John. Here you go. Sure. I would agree that we want to see people in context, living it out. If what we're saying is we designed a 10-week course that said by the end of it they actually could lead because we built it in such a way that they could. We can get into that, but yeah, I would say it could take longer. I think for the most part, allowing the apprentice process, that's the question we have to ask. I don't think there's a right or wrong answer. That's the question we have to ask. What's this going to do to time, right? So if we go this route, what are the implications to quality control?
Potentially higher, at least more cohesive. You know what everyone's heard.
Yeah, you definitely have. You can get one assessment. Everyone gets the same assessment, and you're the pastor, and you get to control that, right? So, quality control. You might miss things, but you're going to know exactly where each person is, rather than having 10 different people have to give you feedback, right? So that's a positive. The negative we already heard about, which was the you don't get to see them in real action, so there's maybe a loss of quality control there, unless you design that training to actually be able to see them do group work, right?
Option number three is
not
a hybrid
role. Yeah, and you know, that's if we talk about ownership, we already talked about what the ownership would be. So if you do all the training yourself, you lose ownership of your coaches and head coaches and leaders to do that. Time may or may not be on your side. But that's the issue, is that when you're deciding on how to train, and this is the big idea that I wanted to get here, when you're deciding on how to train, it's okay to make a decision that takes ownership, that reduces ownership, but you got to know you're making that choice. And I think a lot of the times we make that choice, but we don't know that it has an effect on ownership, right? We just say, hey, we're going to do... and I'm not trying to step on anyone's toes here. We're going to do a new believers class, right? Well, there's other options, right? There's the option of actually doing new believer mentors through your community groups, which would instill ownership in not only your leaders, but your people. And so when we choose things like, hey, we're going to do this thing as a campus or a church, know that that might have some implications, and sometimes it's the right thing to do to take ownership. One of those reasons why would be because of quality control, right? So we'd say, yeah, it'd be great to give them ownership, but we could just, you know, not have a clue who we have out there. And so, you know, what they do at Ballard, and I think what a lot of the campuses are doing now, is we do a hybrid of these two things, right? So we do like a 3-week course where they're, oh, that was a horrible writing. That's why I haven't been drinking. We do a 3-week, they do like a 3-week course to kind of give them the basics and do an evaluation, and then they send them to apprentice in a group. So they do a hybrid of both. And so you're taking a little bit of ownership by saying, I'm going to draw a bunch of people and I'm going to train them kind of basically as kind of a, you know, a church-centric way or central way, and then I'm going to send them out. And you kind of get a little bit of both. Give a little bit of both. So you get some ownership and you get good quality control, or some quality control, right? And so the big idea there is just, hey, like, know, if you're trying to communicate to everyone in your community groups and you decide, I don't trust this chain of communication, and so what I'm going to do is I'm going to send an email to every leader, you're making a choice on ownership, right? You might get better communication, and you may get some coaches that start tuning out because they're not needed. Does that make sense? And so that's not just community ministry. That might be every ministry, but just stuff that, as a pastor, you got to be thinking about, what does this communicate when I do it?
There's a trade-off that you're taking in the secular world. There are times where you go, this is too important.
Yep.
I have to take that risk.
Yep.
Because it's too important of a message to get across.
Exactly.
As long as that's not what you do all the time.
Yeah.
There's room for that.
Yeah, and my point is, make that decision. Just know you're making it, right? And I think that's a mistake we make, is we program or we do things or we build trainings and we don't think about what are the implications and the way it what it communicates and what it does. So exactly. Speaking of unintended consequences, again, not trying to step on anybody's toes. If this is your campus, then you don't have to say anything. We'll never know. So, a campus decided to appoint co-leaders to the community group structure so that there's a lead male and a lead female in every group. Okay? It's just a just a case study. So why would you do that? Why would you do that?
If you have single people in your group and you don't have married couples,
yeah, so you have single people leading the group, you got single guy leading the group, you've got men and women both in the group, and so you want to have someone that the women can go and talk to, and like, it might be inappropriate to go talk to a single dude, right? So, totally makes sense. So what does it communicate? On the positive side, what does it communicate?
We care about all the people in the group.
We care about everybody. We want to make sure that everybody's cared for, everybody's shepherded. That's something we want to communicate. Very important. Anything else that's positive?
Recognizes the gifts of a...
Recognizes the gifts of the women in the group, not just the men? Totally. Does it communicate anything negative?
The male leaders are incapable.
Male leaders are incapable of shepherding women. Only men can only be... shepherded, encouraged, and discipled by other men, and women can only be discipled and shepherded by other women. Didn't intend to communicate that, right? But it does communicate it. And so it means that if I'm a female, I can't talk to my male leader about the stuff I have problems with. I can only talk to the female leader. That could even have implications later on, right? Where I need women's ministry to deal with my issues rather than talk to my husband, right? Could have some unintended consequences. But it communicates good things too. So, like, I'm just playing devil's advocate here. So, what are the benefits?
Twice as many leaders.
You got more leaders. You got women stepping up, leading in places that they haven't been before. So it provides an opportunity for leadership.
It is a solution when there's like a lot of single people in the group, or it helps the fact that if you do have a single male leader, they're kind of like can be short-handed in certain situations.
Sure. So like benefit is like, hey, when the gals really need to talk to a gal about what's going on, there's someone there to talk to. Totally. Yeah. Yeah, so it does provide some protection for the gals. Hopefully, the apprenticeship process and leadership development, we wouldn't have an immature guy in that place, but yeah, that's definitely a benefit. It gives us another level of protection, so totally.
And protection for the male leader as well.
Yeah, totally.
I think it can also demonstrate a great collaboration between male and female leaders.
Totally. They can work together. Can you think of any other unintentional consequences?
There could be like, there's the potential for something weird to go down between the male and female lead. They're
both leaders.
Single people leading in like an intimate kind of leadership relationship together. There could be weirdness there. There has been weirdness.
Happens all the time, right? We started dating. We stopped dating. Who goes? Right?
Who gets the kids?
Yeah. Who gets? Seriously, that's exactly what it is, man. Who gets the kids? Think of any other unintentional consequences to it?
You could unintentionally have people misunderstand sort of our ecclesiology, the way church structure is.
Yep. Sure. Like, so, just understanding why we do, I don't usually share this, because I don't want someone to tweet it and I get shot, so should I share it? I haven't got this, maybe someday Justin will look through my argument for this, but I used to get shot by brochures for this. We only have males lead co-ed groups, and the reason that I do that is because we clearly have a church that is male-governed, right? And we believe that that's reflected in the family. That God even says the way that the husband loves his wife and the wife respects the husband is a reflection of Christ loves the church and the church responds to Christ, right? And so we get this picture of what that's supposed to look like here, and then that gets reflected in the leadership of the church to be male governed because it's a progression of that picture, right? That make sense? The question is, what is a community group? And the community group could be, if it's like just a Bible study and it's a thing you go to, it could be out here. And it might absolutely not matter at all who leads it, right? If I go to a church and their pastoral care and their discipleship structure is built in a different way, then community groups may be something totally other and leadership doesn't matter. At Morris Hill, we look at our community groups as really an extension of both, right? It's an extension of the family, manifestation of the church in which we're actually giving the responsibility of pastoral care to the leaders. We're actually extending some of that authority for pastoral care within those leaders, right? And so to me, it follows in the same structure, which is we want this to look a lot like this and a lot like that. Does that make sense? And so I actually have that's my theological argument. A practical argument is the same argument we'd have, which is a practical argument would be is that I don't know that men and women are created equal but different. And I don't know that if I have 70% of the men at Mars Hill are dealing with porn, I don't want them confessing that to a female leader. I know that that goes in reverse, but I think men and women are built differently, and men are called to handle that. Plus, we have examples in Scripture of single men leading ministries. And then philosophically, we want to call men to leadership, and so it's really weird to say, men, you need to step up and be leaders like your female leader. Philosophically, it doesn't make sense either. So I think there's a philosophical, a practical, and a theological reason why we do that.
We do say, I mean, I've heard it proclaimed that women can be in any position in church other than pastor.
That's true. They can be a community group leader. They just can't be in a community group leader filled with men. And it's not because Scripture says you can't, right? We're not saying that they're prohibited from that. And if you were an Acts 29 church and you had women leading community groups, I wouldn't say that you're unbiblical. I would just say from consistency at Mars Hill, it's just not going to happen here. Like, we just this seems to be the right way to go. So I wouldn't die on a hill for that. Yeah. You know, outside of here, I'd probably die on a hill inside because I think it makes sense. But so, well, maybe we should finish this up, and that maybe might answer it a little bit. But so we have some unintended consequences. Do we answer that one yet? Anything else? One of the unintended consequences is one rule of leadership that I've found to be true is that when you have co-leaders, you have no leaders.
Yes.
So who's really responsible for what went down? And you can say, well, we'd say that the guy really is the overall leader, but that's still like, well, then either one of the things isn't true. Either she's not the co-leader, or he has every right to say, well, I'm only half the leadership. I'm only half responsible for what happened here, right? And so those are some unintended consequences we have to deal with.
You have to define that, like what the roles actually look like if you wanted it to be more of, we saw the benefit in a shepherding situation
mm-hmm.
for women. Maybe you could totally easily define the role with the people involved saying the man teaches and preps for the group and you're here to help come alongside and women have serious problems.
You'd have to do something. Right? You have to do something. So it's a consequence of the decision, right? The decision made sense. There are some consequences. It's going to take some more work. Another thing that it communicates I lost my train of thought. Let's just talk about the implications to structures and systems. So what are the implications to that?
See? Female coaches.
Female coaches, right? Because what if you don't? What do you communicate if you don't? Any thoughts?
It's not as important.
Yeah, so the original intent was to say, we're really important to us that you're cared for and shepherded.
Not enough to give you a coach.
But not enough to give you a coach, which actually, the overall communication is, you know, we're just talking out of both sides of our mouth, right? And so you didn't intend to communicate that, but now you just did. And you didn't intend to do that when you first made that choice, right? That's a bummer, because that wasn't the plan. And then, so if you say, no, we got to solve it. I swear I'm not picking on anybody. I just want you guys to think. you guys gotta think through some of this stuff, because you're going to be in those positions of making decisions, right? Is that we've got neighborhoods. And in those neighborhoods, we have a coach, and that coach is connected to those leaders, right? There's your coach. And they're supposed to be leading them, not only discipling those leaders, but they're supposed to be calling them and leading them on mission. And then, here's my red. Then if we say, well, we don't want the gals to feel bad, so we give them a coach, right? But there's not as many, so they end up coaching women across a bunch of neighborhoods. Now, if she wants to be on mission, she has to connect with this coach. So he's got to connect with her. He's got to connect with her. He's got to connect with those two gals. And if she wants to talk about issues that would be pertinent to women, she's got to talk to that coach. Now we've got two coaches for every one female leader. And if we have 500 community groups, we have to have, what is that, 50? No, that's 100 new coaches to make sure every one of those women for every one of those groups has a coach to talk to, right? And so just know when you're making those decisions, there are implications to them. And if you want to be consistent across it, that could cost us, it costs you a lot of time and a lot of effort. And it may end up communicating the thing that you were trying to communicate the opposite. Make sense?
That sounds like an exercise.
With many different things. It's not just this issue, but
exactly,
it's just like, yeah.
Exactly. So when you are given a new something to consider,
yep.
How do you build into that exercise yourself?
So these are the things that I'm asking. I'm asking, you know, what does this do for ownership is a big question that I ask. How's this going to affect the structure? What are the implications, unintended consequences? And I just try to play devil's advocate and just say, okay, like, so this is good, and I'm doing this for a good reason. And I believe that this is a great reason, that what was trying to be done there was solve a problem that we have. We do have a problem at Marsfield of just really supporting women, and especially women leaders. Last week I hired Hillary Tompkins to be the director of women's ministries across Mars Hill to address these issues so that we can support women leaders and make sure they have a place where they can grow in their leadership and have those spaces, which I think will help this. And the reality is that wasn't there. So when someone made that choice, it was to say, hey, let's address it, right? So I think there's really good reasons to do it, and I don't think anyone was trying to jack stuff up. But that's how I go through it. Just say, okay, it's a good reason, but I'll ask questions like, how does it support this, right? One of the more unfun times in my life was to ask that question about Mars Hill Outdoors. I don't know if you guys, anybody here remember Mars Hill Outdoors?
Yeah.
Brutal. Because that was like from the beginning of Mars Hill, that thing had been around forever, right? But when I started asking the questions like, how does this fit into what Mars Hill is doing? How is it actually making disciples and not making disciples? What are the implications of the structure of having to oversee this and make sure that there's people under authority within it? And at the end of the day, it didn't pass the test, right? And so it had to go, you know. That's the way I kind of weigh through it. I don't know if that's totally helpful. I didn't give you like a clear, like, here's my
But you don't have one.
My grid. Right?
I mean, you just got through the exercise a bunch of times. And
yeah.
Probably try to exhaust your questions that are relevant to that.
Yeah. I mean, that's basically what I'm doing. But I think even these simple questions of how does it make disciples, you know, that's why we even have that thing. That's why we have the picture of a disciple and the book Disciple. It's because we ask the question, what are we trying to do as a church? We're trying to make disciples. What does that look like? Any ministry that's not making disciples we're not keeping around, right? So that's a clear question. And then I add kind of ownership. What's this going to do to the time? Like, I don't want to pick on downtown, but I will just for a minute. They put together a ground war guide, right? Super helpful. I think every campus at some point should probably do the ground war guide, because I think it's really, like, especially when it goes through each neighborhood and what's going on. But one of the things that it said the model for leadership is prophet, priest, and king, and each group should have a prophet, priest, and king in it, right? I don't know if you saw that.
Yeah.
So what is the implications to that?
Three
leaders for every group. Holy, slow down the boat, Batman, right? Like that's going to take forever. I mean, it's hard enough to get one leader to replicate a group, let alone now you got to get three. And so I talked to him about that, and I think they cleared that up. But like...
It says you can only have three leaders.
Now it says, yeah, great. Never mind, slow down the boat anyway. No offense to the priests. So just thinking through those things, like, yeah, what does this do for what we're trying to accomplish, and what does it do for our time, you know?
Yeah, we actually had another recent example like that. Well, we got served.
Yep.
Servers. But even on a surf, like surf team, totally out of contact. You know,
yep.
So downtown, just because of the structure, it was like, okay, well, it makes sense for creating and ushering to be one team. It just made sense. You know, so like, well, merge these teams, and the leader all of a sudden had a bunch of women. Mm-hmm. He did not show up. So I was like, okay, well, let's give him a helper to help. And it ruined the team.
Yep.
Like, just in a hurry. And both of them really talented people. Equally that. And partly because a lot of these things we didn't think through. Like,
yep.
What does this mean? Who's going to own it? Who's going to direct it? And it totally went south. So just another good example of, like, looking at how good intentions can go bad at company.
Yeah. So now you guys are moving towards elder, and you're going to be asked to make decisions, right? And you're going to be on teams that are trying to develop, like, even when the exercise of what are the primary, you know, components of discipleship, you're going to be on elder teams asking that question. And I want you to think through, it's like, wait a minute, what do we actually have in place right now that is making disciples? Let's make sure we don't lose sight of those things. What are the implications of making a choice like doing midweek or not doing midweek, right? Like, make sure you think it through them, right? Do we want to do any more of these? We'll do the pastoral care one. So you're counseling Jim and Pam. Jim has committed adultery, but you spent the last 6 months walking with this couple towards reconciliation. Things are going decent, meaning that they are committed to reconciliation at this point. In your last session, they bring up an issue that they have been working Jim back into Pam's community group. So as when it went all haywire, crazy, Jim went into another community group and Pam stayed in her original group to make sure that she was cared for. And they start to bring Jim back into the original community group. And they've encountered some conflict with the leader of the group. So the conflict has nothing to do with this particular issue. It's just there's a conflict between them and the leaders, and that's a big deal, right? Because in terms of pastoral care, if you haven't heard from Pastor Mike, you will hear from Pastor Mike about the importance of community groups, even in the counseling and redemptive process, right? We want people back in community, want their community group a part of their reconciliation. And so the couple is concerned that they're not being heard and that the and cared for by the leader and his wife, and they want to find another group because we know that importance of involving them. So what do you do with that? And this is not a very artificial example, but knowing the importance of, like, they need to have a caring community that they can trust, because you can't be with them all the time. You just spent 6 months of your life working through probably one of the hardest reconciliations that you've had to do. I mean, that's a really tough issue when someone has cheated. So what do you do?
It sounds like there's more reconciliation that needs to be done between the two couples, the leader and the other. So find out what the heck is going on.
So how do you find out?
I have to schedule a meeting.
Ooh, okay. Schedule a meeting. Come into the pastor's office. All right.
I potentially disagree. I mean, you know, the idea of, like, obviously Jim.
I haven't even said anything. What are you disagreeing with, Bertabucci?
No, I'm disagreeing with
him. Oh, with him.
Okay.
As long as it's not me.
Because, like, you know, I don't care about the disagreement between this couple and that couple. I care about the reconciliation between Jim and Pam.
Mm-hmm.
And so Jim had a huge failing as a spiritual leader,
mm-hmm.
in so many ways. So part of the reconciliation is, how is he doing as a leader? So as opposed to Jim following Pam into her community group, he should be leading in community. So this would be a case where if Pam said, no, I feel safe in this community group, this is where I want to go, then I would pay very close attention to that.
Yeah, so understand, this was the group that they were in together when she found out. So this is the group, this is the community that held her together. When everything blew up. So,
but if they're both, so Jim and Pam, if they're both saying, hey, we should go check out another group, I'd say, I don't know, what's that look like?
Okay. Do you guys agree with them?
If Pam's saying,
should they go to Jim's group? Or
if Pam says, I really feel safe here,
yeah,
I don't want to go to another group, then it's like, you know, I want to pay special attention to that.
you said the couple's ready to go.
Yeah.
So if they're both ready to go, it's like, all right, maybe it's time for a fresh start. I'm okay with that.
You guys agree?
Well, I wouldn't want to jump the gun. I'd want to ask first, you know, have they really tried to voice their concerns to the leader first and foremost, and if they've been honest and direct about, you know, how they've experienced that, what the conflict is. And is Jim especially been a leader in trying to reconcile that with the leader first and foremost?
Sure, so that speaks a little bit to what Pooch is saying, is at least call him to lead in that. So say they do that, what would your recommendation be? They do that and they're still like, we agree to disagree and there's no animosity. What would you, where would you send them?
I'd say you agree to disagree, but I'm not sure what the conflict is then. If they agree to disagree.
So there was a conflict that occurred, they agree to disagree, but there isn't necessarily like
reconciliation.
It's just like, you know, we disagree.
So there's going to be a major rift, is what they're saying.
Yeah, or they just don't care. they're just going to start fresh, right?
Yeah, they need to be told to reconcile rather than
why
leave. Just because they're members of the same covenant community. Those the leaders. But when you can't leave, you should just leave your group because of unreconciled conflict. Like, work towards reconciliation first, and then once that's dealt with, maybe there can be other reasons to leave.
So Paul and Barnabas separated and went their separate ways. There was not, I wasn't there, but I don't.
Paul and Barnabas didn't have any conflict between them. They had a disagreement about Mark, right?
Well, I would say there was conflict between them about Mark, but I mean
they disagreed. They disagreed on whether he should be let back in.
And
but
so when
it's not necessarily
receptive,
like,
is it fit to me?
Well, maybe.
Yeah. Again, my concern is their relationship. Like, I don't care if they go to another community group. I don't care if they need to move them to another campus. And it's like, what's going to be best for their relationship? If in the course of looking at it, like, hey, I'm mad at you because you told me, you called me out on cheating with my wife, then it might be, then the reconciliation might be part of the redemptive process, right? But if I'm mad at you because you like the Troy Lions and I like the Pittsburgh Steelers,
terrible.
It might just be a maturity issue, which is secondary to the redemptive process, right? Where it's like,
well, just like a marriage, though, just like a marriage, you're in a covenant to one another, and you have a relationship, you have an obligation to work through, not to abandon and flee. You have the same obligation in a covenant community and a church. It's the same thing.
But
there's no difference. So you just to just flee.
But
it's
I think
that reconciliation.
So, I'm being asked to circle this.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Totally.
Yeah.
I think it goes back to your earlier argument, one of the first cases that people brought up, and that is that if you just let them go, then what is the community group leader missing in a skill set? That seems to be the bigger issue to me.
Well, not just his skill set, but his heart.
Yeah. Why is he? Is he still pissed off at the guy because he can't see past the fact that he committed the original sin? I mean, what is the nature of the conflict? He needs to be able to take a couple like that where a guy has sinned against his wife, reconciled, repented, and then embrace him back into the community. If he doesn't have that heart / attitude / skill set, then he's not a, he needs to grow in that.
Mm-hmm.
It's not really a skill set, though. It's a response.
It's a response to the gospel.
Right.
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 Does anyone else have any additional thoughts on that?
I just want to see that whole community group that these people were a part of. I want them to see the transformative work that Christ has done in these people's lives because they've known him. When you take them out of that mix and you put them somewhere else, they may or may not proclaim the glory of God and what he's done to reconcile their relationship. We're in this community. Like, this is a testimony of God's goodness by what he's doing right there, and they know it because they walked through it.
Mm-hmm.
So I would really try to hit that leader part of what the issue is that they can't get over and just speak
Yeah.
Because right, Jesus isn't what he's done.
Yeah, because, I mean, make no mistake, if you're that guy and you left the community, like, that whole community is rallying around her, absolutely, right? And they are protecting her, as they should, from him. And there's an aspect of reconciliation that needs to just happen in that community for them to see what God's doing and for them to reconcile, right? So that we can all say, hey, the power of the gospel is not just going to be a miracle in your life. It's going to be a miracle in all of our lives as we reconcile together, right? Huge deal. Huge deal for that whole thing to happen. That's the difference between seeing something as individualistic versus seeing something as community, is that there's implications across for everybody, right?
And it seems like it's really good for marriage, for reconciliation within the community to happen. You know what I mean? Like,
yeah. Because what? You're telling them, reconcile. Why? Because you've sinned against each other. But when it comes to community, meh. You know? I mean, you're saying like, you know, I'm sitting with a couple saying that Jesus is bigger than you committing adultery on your wife. It's not bigger than you being offended by your community group leader.
Yeah.
that's just a stupid message, right? And we do, this is so common, guys.
Well, I guess my fear, I guess I just cut you off, I'm sorry.
Yeah, no worries.
But my fear is the law versus grace, where it's like, hey, for you to truly be reconciled, you have to redeem with this community group.
No, it's not saying that you have to. It's saying that The question that I'm always asking is what is the most gospel centered response? What is the most Christ glorifying response? And in the midst of that, reconciliation, right? That we don't just part ways because we disagree, but we actually work things out because of the reconciliation of the cross. And so I'm not going to part ways just because there's conflict, right?
And I don't want to go too far down the three rabbit trails, but like.
We've been down this before.
No,
that's like, sorry, inside joke.
But thinking about about leading your wife and the importance of the ministry of our marriage.
Yep.
Right. So if you came to me as a dude and said, "Yeah, I don't like Ben's community group. You know, he's kind of a bum. Whatever." I'd be like, "That's kind of lame. You guys should work it out."
Yep.
If you came to me and said, "My wife doesn't like Ben's community group," I would say, "All right, why not? Okay, this and this." And I had a similar conversation with a guy today, and I'm like, "All right, what's it going to look like for you to help your wife get into the community group?" Mm-hmm. And I might tell you, you might need to go to a different community group. So, it doesn't make sense where it's like. Because I'm not going to be like, dude, you need to force your wife to like Ben's community group.
No, but you're setting up a straw man to say, you know, you might need to shepherd your wife to understand that community is not about what you get out of it and what you like. Community is about what Christ has done. And so if a conflict has occurred, then we need to actually let the gospel come to bear on our relationship with our community group leader so that we can reconcile. Because there's nothing... in our sin against one another, there's nothing bigger than that reconciliation. White as snow, right? And so we should be. So I would tell the guy, why don't you shepherd your wife to a place where there's reconciliation? Extreme case. I had a. this is a couple years ago. I had a gal come to me and said, "Want to talk to me?" And the story was, and we got till 9, right? So you guys are. If you want to leave at any time, you totally can. The gal came and wanted to leave the community group. And I said, "Well, why do you want to leave the community group?" And she said, "Well, because the leader's wife, I believe, sinned against me." And what happened? Well, she said, "Well, we had a meeting, and I confessed sin." And in front of the group, she said that my confession wasn't legitimate, or that my confession was worldly, and she accused me in front of the whole group, and then it exploded. People were arguing and yelling, and I feel like I've been sinned against by the leader's wife, and I don't want to go back to the group. easiest thing I could have done right there is I could have said, well, you're a single woman. You've been sinned against by this wife. You feel like you were ganged up by the leader. The leader didn't protect you. You shouldn't go back. Let me find another group for you. But for me, I don't believe that that's the gospel. And so instead of saying, go and reconcile, I said, okay, I'll meet you at your community group. And we sat down, not just with the community group leader and his wife, we sat down with the entire community group, and we said, okay, this is what happened. And the reason you're all in on this is because you're all a part of it. Either you were with the women when this happened and you all went there, you know, or you were in the group and it all exploded after. Everyone saw it. The mess is out there. Let's deal with it with everybody, right? And we just sat down and we worked through it. And the reality was that the single gal was in sin. And the wife did sin against her in her response. And the leader did sin in the way that he didn't protect and he didn't lead in the midst of it, right? And the other folks for gossiping and, you know, like it was just like, we're all culpable. But you're not going to leave this group until we address it, right? If you want to leave after we've been able to confess sin and forgive one another, and then you want to leave, we'll do it then. But we're not going to leave, you know, agreeing to disagree. We're going to agree that we need the work and the power of the Holy Spirit in our lives to forgive one another, and we're going to walk through that, right? We do this all the time. We let people off the hook and just say go. And then the leader never grows. The group never grows. The person never grows. And we end up giving them this reason. You're not comfortable. You're not being fed. You don't like it. You didn't feel heard. So go to find one that you do, rather than saying, you, like you guys said, covenant to community. You made a covenant with these people. This is your family. You don't just say, I'm no longer a part of the house family. Like, my kids don't get to do that because I asked my kids to eat broccoli, right? They have to reconcile with dad about why they don't think they need to, why I've sinned against them by putting green things on their plate. Like, we got to work it out, right?
On a smaller note, that's exactly what creates the whole shopper mentality.
Yes.
Where it's like, I don't stay at a community group until I feel like it's my people. It's
yep.
The people I would normally affiliate with, which is not.
But the indicative is it is your people.
And the unintended consequence of letting someone roll is not just that they didn't learn a lesson, right? Everyone in that group learned a lesson. If my needs aren't met, if I don't like it, I can roll. You know, you do that enough times, and now you've got a you know, ethos problem on your hands, right? So, there's a few questions on the back that you need to fill out and send to Mr. Tyler Powell, the Tyler Powell. If we all look at Tyler Powell long enough, half of his face will turn red.
Yeah.
Here it goes. Here it goes. I told you. He has to wear makeup when he preaches. Questions?
Everything that we ever talk about, always people sticking in with the group because of the why.
Yep.
Can you talk quickly about when you would say, in what scenarios, you would say, yes, it's time for you to find another group?
Sure. I mean, there's a couple times when I would say even time for everybody to find another group. One is like, if we get a... So the why is because, you know, we talk about the why is because of what Jesus did. That has two implications. One, that means that we're reconciled to one another, and it also means that we've been invited into the mission of God, right? So one clear reason of when it's time to separate is when it's Paul and Barnabas, when it's better for the mission, right? And ultimately we see that, like, so very clearly, like, yeah... when would I tell?
How about in a negative
sense? To be honest, if I couldn't get especially if it was with a leader, if I couldn't get a leader to the point of reconciliation, I'd probably end up removing the leader before, and I might disband the group at that point because of poor leadership, or I might install new leadership for some change. But the problems that I've had mostly, like, and I can count them on my hand, where reconciliation was difficult was in a prideful, prideful leader. It's like, I mean, we just had one. I just talked with somebody about a guy. I don't even know his name, so I can't get any trouble stepping anybody's toes. But like a leader at one of our campuses was, I didn't sin against that person. I said what I said, and I don't need any more reconciliation. It's like, I don't know if you sinned or not, but your attitude is sinning, right? Like you don't care. You don't care if there's reconciliation. It's like, okay, we've got a leader problem, right? And so there may be times when I ask maybe that's the answer to the question, is like if someone's unrepentant, if there's unrepentant sin, like if I went into that and the leaders were like, no, we didn't sin against you, and we're going to keep doing what we're doing, then I'm like, okay, you're going to go, but you're going to go knowing that you did everything you could towards reconciliation, and they're in sin, not you, right? And so that's probably when I would say it's time to go if there's unrepentance.
Then the group will get disbanded.
At least the leader will get disbanded. Disbarred.
Dismembered.
Dismembered. Yeah, there might be follow-up there. Cool. There is one we didn't do on just kind of, and maybe probably was one of the more important ones, but just how do you motivate a neighborhood that if you're a pastor, you're overseeing groups, or you're part of a leadership team, you've got neighborhoods that aren't growing, either losing groups or they're just staying stagnant. Think through those things. Like, okay, I think a lot of times when we talk about ownership of our people, I think as pastors sometimes we get stuck in our niche. So I can be a community groups pastor, and I can just totally check out on Sunday. It's not my problem. That's Cam's problem. Cam will take care of it, right? And really taking ownership of the whole thing. Sometimes, when it comes to, like you might be a biblical living pastor or a executive pastor, and like community groups are the community group guy's problem. I want you to understand that you're leading the church, you're leading it all, and you have a responsibility on Sunday to make sure that that event glorifies Jesus and people get to know who he is, and you're part of baptisms, talking to people up front, meeting people and greeting people. And when it comes to community, we're all responsible for that. Our goal is to make sure that we don't gather 50,000 people at Mars Hill, right? That's not our goal. Our goal is to see 50,000 people's lives transformed by Jesus. And so we have no legacy, and I said it in the book, and I'll say it again. We have no legacy if all we do is gather people. If the gospel must penetrate their lives, and that's our responsibility, and that's what your responsibility is, an elder at Mars Hill. Cool?
Yeah.